This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
When I've gone to the large Asian seafood markets, I've been really struck by the sense that it just seems impossible that the oceans are going to be able to keep up with the demand, and particularly given the preference for large carnivorous species like tuna, which are now at a population level that's about a 20th of what it was in the 1970s.
Making responsible choices as a seafood consumer has never been more complicated. An average fish eater might be aware that tuna is high in mercury or that Chilean sea bass is overfished. But I know I have to refer to my pocket seafood watch guide when I peruse the fish counter at my local grocery store to make sure that I'm choosing something that is A, sustainable, B, not filled with toxins, and C, something I know how to cook. One of the developments in the 21st century seafood industry, for better or for worse, is the growing market share that farmed fish represents. But are farmed fish sustainable? What makes one farmed fish a more responsible choice than another, or than a wild-caught fish? My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Josh Goldman, the CEO of Australis Aquaculture, the world's largest producer of barramundi, or what the company calls sustainable sea bass. Goldman walks us through innovations in aquaculture and tells me everything I've always wondered about fish farming, from why there aren't any tuna farms to whether the all-powerful Japanese seafood industry is finally coming around to more responsible production practices. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Josh Goldman. He's the CEO of Australis Aquaculture. It's a sustainable seafood company. Josh, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. Great to be here.
So first, tell us a little bit about Australis Aquaculture, the history of it, and what got you involved in this part of the business.
We're 8 years old. We were actually founded in Australia with the idea of bringing Australia's iconic fish, the barramundi, to wider markets around the world. But the real background was my own history in developing land-based closed containment systems. And at a certain point along the way, realizing that if that technology was going to be successful, we really needed to marry it up with fish that made more sense to farm based on ecological as well as market principles.
And you are the world's largest producer of barramundi. Now, what is barramundi and why did you decide to go with this breed of fish?
Barramundi are native to the top of Australia and the Indo-Pacific. So they go through Indonesia, Vietnam, all the way over to Sri Lanka and India. And they've been called the anti-salmon because they have the opposite life history. They spawn in the marine environment on a lunar cycle, and then they travel into freshwater to mature. They have great culinary characteristics. This is a oily white fish with lots of omega-3s. And yet, because it matures in the freshwater environment, nature's endowed it with the ability to eat lower on the food chain. So in that life history, we saw kind of a great set of characteristics to solve some of the big problems that we face in the food system and seafood in particular.
Now, is barramundi advertised as barramundi, or is this a stealth brand of Chilean sea bass or something of its ilk?
Yeah, you may have heard that Chilean sea bass are Patagonian toothfish, but in this case, barramundi is the accepted market name for the fish, and it comes from one of the Australian Aboriginal languages. So if you're going to find it in a supermarket or a restaurant in the U.S., you're going to see it labeled as barramundi. In other parts of the world, it's sometimes called Asian sea bass.
And does it taste like Chilean sea bass that we've had back, that used to be a lot more popular in the 90s?
It's in, I guess, the same overall kind of flesh archetype. It's a dense fleshed white fish, not as oily as Chilean sea bass, probably more similar to our striped bass or a grouper or a snapper.
And it's a saltwater fish.
It's a saltwater fish. It's actually what we call urehaline. It can move between fresh and saltwater. It's tolerant of both, but the majority of our farming takes place all in saltwater.
How did you decide that Barramundi was the breed that you could farm successfully and sustainably?
I originally was involved back in the 1980s with tilapia, which are an herbivorous fish that's now widely farmed and widely available in markets. But as we developed that species, we realized that it didn't completely deliver on the promise of aquaculture, which, in addition to providing healthy protein, is also about helping rebalance what we eat and deliver more omega-3s. Most tilapia today have a fatty acid profile that looks not too different than hamburger, some studies have suggested, because they're corn-fed. So I began to do ecological prospecting and look around the world for fish that maybe had a different life cycle. And in the Barramundi, we found a fish that, because of its movement between fresh and salt water, had the ability to eat low on the food chain and therefore have a smaller environmental footprint, but without compromising the human health benefits that seafood uniquely provides to us.
Why don't you give us the history of tilapia, and if you could walk us back to when you started learning about this fish, are there any population studies that show tilapia at X amount in the 80s, and then after 30 years of farming and eating this fish, where they are now?
Yeah, in general, if you look at the whole aquaculture industry, it's often called the fastest growing kind of major part of the food system. Aquaculture now supplies nearly half of the fish that people consume on a global basis. And that's really a good thing, because we now know that it's simply impossible for the oceans to keep up with demand or the recommended quantities of fish that government advise people to eat. In the case of tilapia, it really followed a production-driven model. Tilapia was used for development projects around the world because it was amenable to being grown in ponds throughout developing countries and didn't require high quality feed. So it's really fit a unique niche in that sense.
But in terms of the population of tilapia, do you have an idea about the wild tilapia? How has that been affected by the farming of its brethren?
Well, tilapia came of age as a farm species before there was a lot of awareness about the issue of invasives. So tilapia has inadvertently or on purpose been introduced to a lot of environments where it's not native. And so it's probably much more widespread as a wild fish, although not for the right reasons. In its home habitat in Africa, where there's an enormous genetic reserve or a lot of importance of maintaining the genetic diversity of the native species, unfortunately, it's not faring as well because of introductions of other species.
Welcome to the club. On my door I'd hang a sign, gone fishing instead of just a wishing.
Papa Bing, I've stopped by your place a time or two lately, and you aren't home either.
Well, I'm a busy man, Louie. I got a lot of big deals cooking. I was probably tied up at the studio.
You aren't tied up, you dog. You was just playing old gone fishing. There's a sign up on your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. They each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Josh Goldman. He's an aquaculture expert and the founder and CEO of Australis Aquaculture. So we hear about the seafood watch list. Species get saved and then they become more endangered, and it's kind of this cycle. So where are we right now?
Well, sometimes what happens is fish that become greenlisted, their popularity increases, and that may work against the conservation objectives. Typically, it's a little bit simpler on the farm side because the practices can be better defined, and it's not as complicated as assessing wild-caught fisheries. So if you look, for example, at the Monterey Best Choice List, you're going to see strong representation of farm species, things like Arctic char, barramundi, catfish, cobia, which is another relatively new species. And if they're going to make that grade, they're going to have been produced in a way where there are minimal habitat effects, where the use of wild fish in the feed is resulting in a net increase in protein as opposed to a reduction, using more wild fish to produce each unit of farm fish. So those are some of the key variables at play.
Tell us about some of the species that have given aquaculture a bad name. You mentioned how the tilapia was kind of one of the first. What are some of the nightmare stories that have corrupted your industry?
Well, aquaculture, despite its long history, has gone through very rapid development. In the 1980s, people figured out how to reproduce shrimp, and shrimp farming went through a global boom, often without regard to the environment in which the farming took place. And so in many locations, mangroves, which are incredibly important ecosystems both for wild fisheries and for carbon sequestration, were destroyed through the creation of shrimp farms. Salmon aquaculture has had a pretty challenged history in certain locations where it interacts with wild stocks, often because the best place to locate a salmon farm may be where there's a native salmon run, and each of those rivers represents a unique genetic strain of salmon that deserves protection.
So you're an expert in this field. When you go to the grocery store and you see three or four different types of salmon, there's wild caught, there's wild caught without the color, there's farmed with the color, and there's probably two or three other varieties. It's pretty mind-numbing to somebody who's just kind of in a rush and has a screaming kid right next to them. What do you buy?
You know, I love the wild salmon because you're getting a unique seasonal product, but I'm also not adverse to eating farm salmon. I think the industry doesn't get as much credit as it really deserves for improving a lot of the practices that that improve the product quality and they reduce the environmental impacts.
And what countries are kind of a red flag to you if you saw it comes from Malaysia or China, or where are some of the countries that you might be a little less eager to make that purchase from?
China, I think, deservedly raises a lot of questions with respect to seafood because there's so much production of such a wide variety of species in relatively crowded environments and without a lot of government oversight. We operate farms of our own in central Vietnam, and we're in an absolutely pristine environment. So ultimately, one has to look to the producer. But in the case of China, I think it's very difficult to do that because many farms' production is being collected in a way that doesn't afford traceability back to the source.
And what do you feed your barramundi in your farms in Vietnam?
So we've developed a feed that exploits the ability of the fish to eat low on the food chain. So it's about 80% grain-based, that being soy, wheat, canola, and a corn protein concentrate. And then about 20% fish-based, and of that, about one-third is derived from byproducts.
And how would that differ from a wild barramundi in terms of its fatty content and its general health content?
So we've actually been able to significantly increase the fat level in our fish relative to what you'd typically find in a wild-caught barramundi.
And is that catering a little bit to, as people have developed taste for fattier fish from eating sushi?
It is. And I think you find, you know, fattier fish are less resistant to overcooking, and so they're easier to work with. Fat contributes flavor, and in the case of fish, it contributes a lot of health benefits. The key is to make sure that when you're adding fat, you're not also adding pollutants. So the ability to segregate the ingredients and manage what you're feeding them across the life cycle so that you have a very pure product at the end is something that we've done and quite successfully.
They call it the fish. Is it a salmon that comes in a can?
No.
Is it a flounder you fry in a pan?
No.
What is this new dance I'm asking you, man? They call it the fish. Is it a tuna you catch on a hook?
No.
Is it a minnow that swims in a brook?
No.
What is this new step that makes me cook? They call it the fish. Rock a little left foot, 1, 2, 3. Roll a little right foot, bend your knee. Use the ocean motion, calm and cool. Rock and roll, your baby, that's the only rule. Am I a lobster?
If you ever find yourself wanting to know more about the music we play here on Sea Change Radio, go to seachangeradio.com and click on the Music tab at the top of the page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Josh Goldman. He's the CEO of Australis Aquaculture. It's the world's largest producer of barramundi. Josh, this is kind of an enormous topic, but let's dive into the sushi industry as a whole. Tell us about going to Tsukiji Market in Tokyo and seeing the buying and selling of these enormous tuna and some of the other more prized fish and how that makes you feel as an aquaculturist.
Well, when I've gone to the large Asian seafood markets, I've been really struck by the sense that it just seems impossible that the oceans are going to be able to keep up with the demand, and particularly given the preference for large carnivorous species like tuna, which are now at a population level that's about a 20th of what it was in the 1970s. And thus my passion for farming fish in ways that coexist and ultimately promise to help us rebuild abundance in the seas.
Have the Japanese been taking some steps to try to rein in some of the practices that helped reduce the tuna levels to the 20% of what they were in the 70s? Or are they late to the sustainable party when it comes to seafood?
The Japanese seem to have resisted the pressures from other nations. There was a point at which bluefin were being strongly considered for a CITES listing under the Endangered Species Act internationally, and the tuna and the Japanese put their national interest and I guess their food culture in the way of conservation. So they certainly have not exhibited a lot of leadership.
Are Japanese companies customers of Australis Aquaculture? Has the farmed fish taken off at all in Japan?
We have not made inroads in the Japanese market, but I think there is hope in the sense that younger people seem to be much more attuned to this issue. And for example, in China, where there's been a historic use of shark fin, very destructive practices at weddings, we're hearing reports that many young people are rejecting this practice on conservation grounds.
I saw that basketball star Yao Ming has become an activist for this issue.
He has, and that's great to see that happen.
Your Vietnamese farm operations recently received a global GAP certification, and more companies like yourselves are making sure that they're meeting and hopefully exceeding global standards. Can you talk about how that's evolved, the standardization process, and how that fits in with the entire sustainability movement?
Yes. Well, the conservation community, principally concerned with the health of the oceans, has done a really great job of building awareness amongst major end users in sustainable certification of seafood. And that's resulted in things like the Marine Stewardship Council, Global GAP, and other efforts, demand for sustainable seafood has risen dramatically. NPR just released a poll in which they indicated 80% of seafood purchasers are interested to ensure that the seafood they eat is sustainable. The question really is, where do we set the bar to ensure that the market forces are aligned with ultimately the conservation objectives?
We had talked about some of the breeds that are more endangered than others, but tuna seems to be one of the most ubiquitous fish in our diet, whether it be at a sushi restaurant and some of the most expensive cuts of tuna, or just getting a chunk light can for next to nothing. Can you explain where tuna is now, the different breeds, and if there's any efforts underway to harvest and sustainably fish tuna?
Well, tuna, of course, are highly migratory species, so they don't obey the political geographies of governments. They move broadly through national and into international waters, and so most of their conservation has to occur through international agreements. And this fundamentally makes them more difficult to conserve, because that system of conservation is essentially requires unanimous support. So even a small fishing country can block the conservation of a species like tuna through its objections. So it's really incumbent upon us as consumers and the professional buying community to use certification that's science-based to ensure that we're not continuing to oversee the decline of these species.
And they can't be farmed? Can you have like a small bay or inlet just filled with tuna? Or is this just not something that would allow the species to grow?
To date, there has not been reliable reproduction of most tuna species. So the farming which takes place is effectively ranching, in which smaller juvenile fish are captured, held in pens, and then fed. Wild-caught fish that are harvested around the pens. And that activity seems to make good economic sense in a lot of cases, but tuna are very energetic animals. They require enormous amounts of wild fish in the diet to grow. And so one ends up not really adding to the supply through the current methods of tuna farming.
And they kind of have to grow to that adulthood in order to reproduce. So is that one of the challenges, I imagine, in terms of reproducing them in captivity?
Yeah, they seem to be very difficult to get the eggs to succeed in captivity. And of course, when you capture them, you're taking those animals out of the prospective breeding population, as well as the fact that you're needing to capture a lot of fish to then do the fattening.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Josh Goldman. He's the CEO of Australis Aquaculture. It's the world's largest producer of barramundi. Josh, are there any fish or similar seafood products that we should be looking out for in the years to come? Ones that haven't really hit the market yet that you're excited about?
There's a lot of interesting species in Brazil, Amazonian species, many of which are air breathing. One called the piraracu that's very interesting. Part of what aquaculture needs to do to really fulfill its mission is to begin to farm in environments that haven't historically produced seafood in harmony with nature. And this is an opportunity to undertake conservation of an endangered animal while producing livelihood for traditional peoples in the Amazon. So we're excited about that one.
The CEO of Australis Aquaculture, Josh Goldman, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was great, Alex. Thank you.
While we still have a few minutes left on the show, I wanted to read an excerpt from Yale Environment 360, July 19, 2012 issue, entitled, "Will Fish-Loving Japan Embrace Sustainable Seafood?" by Winifred Bird. We'll link to this at seachangeradio.com. The Food and Agricultural Organization of the United States estimates that more than 80% of the world's fish stocks are fully exploited, overexploited, or recovering. Many Japanese are aware of those dismal figures. Yet, eating seafood is a central part of national food culture. So much so, says Greenpeace Japan's Oceans Campaign Manager Wakao Hanaoka, that some people think they have a right to eat it, and they don't want outsiders telling them not to. That, along with other cultural and institutional factors, means the notion of sustainable seafood still faces an uphill fight in Japan. If more Japanese consumers embrace seafood sustainably, they could have a significant impact on ocean ecosystems. The Japanese eat 6% of the world's fish harvest, 81% of its fresh tuna, and a significant chunk of all salmon, shrimp, and crab. Japan also imports more seafood than any other country and caught 4.2 million metric tons of fish in 2008. The commitment by Walmart, McDonald's, and other major companies to buy only sustainably caught seafood is an encouraging sign in an otherwise bleak global fisheries picture. After decades of government inaction and ineffective consumer campaigns, corporate pressure may finally be starting to turn the tide on reckless overfishing. But Aiko Yamauchi, WWF Japan's fishery and seafood project leader, sees sustainable seafood as a positive way to approach the issue. "We're trying to improve troubled fisheries, not just tell people to avoid eating fish," he says. "The global movement is not opposed to Japanese culture. That approach is slowly starting to work. Ultimately, however, trends that have nothing to do with sustainability may dwarf the progress WWF and other organizations have made in Japan. Fish consumption is falling as people buy more meat and convenience foods, and annual fish harvest has fallen by more than half since 1985 as both fishing communities and fish stocks decline. Meanwhile, aquaculture production, fish processing, and seafood consumption are all booming in neighboring China, which now consumes about one-third of the world's fish. Whether lessons from Japan prove useful remains to be seen." This will be posted on seachangeradio.com. Thanks again for listening.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Leo Kotke, Louis Armstrong and Bing Crosby, and Big Mama Thornton.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.